As I'm being followed by a moon shadow, leaping and hopping on a moon shadow.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and this week we are very, very pleased to have back visiting the Cave of Solitude, the incomparable Mr. J.M. DeMatteis. Good sir, welcome back, and thank you for coming to visit again.
Happy to be here.
So, I want to start off by saying congratulations, because tomorrow is a pretty big day for you, because coming to the stores and digitally, I imagine both at the same time, you've got two books hitting the shelves tomorrow.
You have the conclusion
to Impossible Incorporated, issue right. 5. And then, as well, you've got issue 3 of The Girl in the Bay, which both of them have been very imaginative and excellent, and I've enjoyed the ride so far. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I'm having a great time. You know, what's wonderful is that they're both very different books. Girl in the Bay is, it's with Karen Berger's new line at Berger Books, and it has that kind of classic Vertigo feel. It's a little dark, it's a little twisty, and it's a mature reader's book. Impossible Incorporated is more of and I hesitate to use the word all ages, only because I know some older readers like blanch when they hear, I'm not going to read that, that's an all ages book. Meaning that I want a 10-year-old to be able to pick it up, read it, and really enjoy it, and a 35-year-old to be able to pick it up and read it and enjoy it. So it's fun bouncing back and forth between two books that are very, very different, and yet I'm having just an equal good time with both. Corinne Howell's doing the art on Girl in the Bay. She's very new to me, but she just has knocked it out of the park on this book, and I think she's got an amazing career ahead of her. And my old friend Mike Cavallaro, who I've done a number of projects with, is doing Impossible Incorporated with me, and it's been a blast. It's been a blast.
And I think you described both of those books really well, because full disclosure, I'm a 35-year-old man who's reading Impossible Inc., and I got to say, Mike Cavallaro's art is... it's very kid-friendly, easy to follow. It's not overly, like, it's not shocking or demanding for someone to look at it and know what's going on, but it really challenges you because it's a high-concept book.
Yes.
And it takes
and he's,
you
he's got to go kind of all Ditko and Kirby throughout this thing with other dimensions and, you know, strange new worlds and, you know, journeys into the ether. And so he's really he's such an imaginative artist. And he's also someone who is just an impeccable storyteller. Panel to panel, everything is just crystal clear and you can't ask for anything more. And Impossible Incorporated has been sort of in a way, someone described it to me, another writer, as a part Fantastic Four, part Doc Savage, and part Doctor Who. I thought, I'll take that. It's a big cosmic adventure. The lead character is a 16-year-old girl named Number Horowitz. Her father is this mythic sort of cosmic adventurer out of the Reed Richards, Doc Savage mold, but he's been missing for years, so she's had to take over the family business, essentially. So while they're having these grand cosmic adventures, is also the story of a girl and her father and her mother as well, family ties, longing and loss, and searching for this father who they're not sure if he's dead or alive at the start of a story. So it works on a lot of different levels, and it's just been a lot of fun. So we're wrapping it up. I think the collected edition will be out in May from IDW, and we're hoping that that does well enough that we get to do more, because we could be working on this book forever, really.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask that. What made you, first of all, what were you channeling inspiration-wise when you're putting this book together? Because there is a simplicity to it. The first issue, you kind of feel like, I think I know where this is going. I bet her father's going to show up at some point, the one who's missing. Spoilers, I guess, for people who haven't read it yet. But it goes into these high concept areas of metaphysics and science fiction, but then also like contemplating your reality. Like, what's inspiring you to write this?
Well, you know, it started from a couple of places. One, some years back, Mike and I were having a conversation, and I was remembering being a kid reading those sort of old classic early 60s DC Superman stories that were sometimes 8 or 10 pages, but just chock full of imagination and big concepts, and enough to kind of stuff the head of any kid with so much imagination. And we were talking about getting back to that kind of story where it's not about violent confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
It's about imagination. I don't know if there's any violence anywhere in Impossible Incorporated. You know, there might be the threat of violence.
Right.
Here and there, you know, and some things kind of blink in and out of existence. It's about as bad. But there's no classic, say, you know, superhero slugfest.
No.
So the challenge is, but you can still do big adventure filled with imagination and struggle and conflict and threat. But again, with the emphasis more on the imagination than on the violence. And then as we start to work on it, both of us are huge Kirby fans. You know, Kurt Lee Kirby, Fantastic Four, Kirby's stuff at DC in the 70s. So that kind of bled in. And then, you know, there's who I am, which is the story itself becomes a metaphor for, I think, the journey that we're all on, which is exploring the universe from right here where we are, you know, our own metaphysical, spiritual explorations, scientific explorations of reality, kind of what you're saying. What is this? Where are we? What does the universe look like, and what is it really, and who are we in the midst of all this sort of chaos and wonder? And so it's a great vehicle. They travel around in what looks like a subway train called the non-local express, which can travel across what we've invented and called the infinite spiral, which is essentially the doorway to everything.
Okay.
Every level and layer of reality, parallel universes, other dimensions, other worlds, everything. And so literally, we have so many stories we can continue to tell once this one is done, that I really do hope that we get to have more adventures with these characters. And again, it is with all the cosmic adventuring and philosophy. I mean, in the last issue, she essentially meets God. But it's grounded in character. It's grounded in her search and her relationship with the other characters, her relationship with her family. So it's that balance that I think you have to have between big ideas and characters that the readers can relate to.
Right. So I was going to ask you what the spiral represented, but you answered that. Do you feel that something like that, I mean, in your imagination, I'm sure it does, but I feel like something like that I wish existed, where you can take that New York City looking train and travel to a place where anything is possible as far as space and time goes. Like, what, when you were young, were those things that captured that for you to be like, I wonder if? Or even now, where do you get?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, that's the way I look at the universe. I really believe that maybe it's more internally than externally. You know, we can't. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can. We just don't know it. Can't hop on a cosmic subway train. But when we dive inward, when we dive within ourselves, the doorway to all universes is inside us, you know, and I've spent most of my life traveling through those internal universes. So this is just an externalization of journeys that I think we're all on. And then there's that doorway between what's internal and what's external. And a part of me really believes to the core of my being that just as easily as we can make those internal journeys, there's a little switch that can be flipped somewhere. And maybe we will be traveling outwardly through the infinite spiral and through these sort of Kirby-esque and Ditko-esque dimensions and the levels and layers so-called reality and the deeper reality that lies beneath that.
Right. So metaphorically, what do the time termites in the story represent? Because part of the conflict that you were mentioning before is reality basically unraveling itself and time coming to an end. So what do the time termites in that effect, in that term, represent?
You know, after a certain point, I don't like to break down a story and say this element represents this and this element represents that. You know, what I like is just to sort of get my concept going, know where I'm going with it, and then just uncork my unconscious. So I could probably tell you 6 months from now more of what the time termites represent, you know, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
as opposed to me just going, oh my God, what's that? It's time termites. They're eating at the foundation of the infinite spiral, and it's all collapsing. You know, and I could probably tell you 20 things right now that it represents, but I would rather let the reader come to the story. You know, talk about the big themes, certainly, but let the reader come to the story and find those little bits of symbolism, and 20 people will read that and come away with 20 different interpretations of what that might mean. And then the flip side is you don't have to have an interpretation of what it might mean just to enjoy a grand adventure, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you really...
That make sense to you?
No, absolutely. That question came to me because as I was reading the story, at first I'm like, okay, this is what this tool is being used as. But then when they weren't quite as malevolent as you're maybe expecting them to be, you're starting to think to your... For me, I started to, you know, expand my mind a little bit. And I think that's the point of your story, is to think a little bit more about
what's
around you and what certain things in your own life, personal life, could be those time termites to you. So I was wondering if in the story there was something that those things represented that you were using them as more than just, oh, they're you know, the malevolent thing that they've got to defeat, because I don't think it's that simple.
Right. And you know, now I'm remembering our last conversation because you kept asking me questions that answered them so beautifully. Just what you said about the thing that seems to be a threat that when viewed differently becomes something very different is sort of an essential part, I think, of life and our growth, you know, especially when we look at the world now where everybody is so invested in other, in making everyone other. And there's this huge, the them versus us mentality mm-hmm. feels like it's never been bigger than it is right now, you know, the demonization of other. And I think it's so important as human beings and as storytellers to realize that other is us.
Right.
You know, and so that is a big part of what that time termite confrontation is about. And yet it's also just, as I said, part of this big adventure with wonderful concepts. And just, you know, one day some phrase comes to me, time termites. That's cool. Well, what are they? Let's follow that idea and see where it leads, you know? So kind of going back to what I was saying before, on one level, it's just my unconscious spitting these things out. And then you think about it and go, yeah, well, that's what that's about. And you know, as writers, we have the themes that we kind of return to obsessively, which are the themes that tend to obsess us in life. Mm-hmm. So you can look at all my stories, no matter what the genre may be, whether it's geared toward all ages or adults, or it's autobiographical, or it's fantasy, or it's superheroes, and you will find similar themes running through that. And what we're talking about now is a theme that runs through all my work. So it's never just one thing or another. You know, a piece of writing is sort of everything. It's the totality of what the writer is, regardless of whether he or she intends it or not. I often look back at certain stories that I thought, yeah, it's just another story. And I look back later, I go, oh my God, I revealed such profoundly deep parts of myself in that story that I thought I was knocking out very quickly because I had a very tight deadline, you know? So it's always like a Rorschach test, every story. For me, I can look at it and then see the depths of my own psyche reflected back at me, you know?
Yeah, a lot of people, they say sometimes with poetry, sometimes the in poetry, it's you're writing what you think you're writing, but then later on, like what you brought up with the unconscious self, you were connecting dots with ideas and things that work so wonderfully together, but you didn't necessarily intend that to be. But when you pull back from it, there's so much more on that tapestry, as it were.
To see it
all come together.
As I think we probably talked about last time, mm-hmm. I see writing as a continual process of surrendering to the unconscious. And the unconscious is just what you know. So you're just kind of following the story. You're following the characters. The stuff, when it's really working, the stuff is gushing out of you. Mm-hmm. And you, like I said, you may have started with your themes and your ideas about the characters, but once it starts going, it just goes. And my job is to get out of the way. And later on, I may look and go, oh, well, that's interesting. That's what that is. And that, so there are certain things that you're putting in consciously, but there's a whole other level of things that's just gushing forth from the unconscious, and it's wonderful to take a step back and look at those things later and see, well, that's what that story was about. I didn't know that when I was writing it. I thought I was writing about A, and I was, but I was also writing about B, C, D, and E. And then someone else can read that story and find E, F, and G, and their interpretation is just as valid as mine. So it's an interesting and magical process, and I always like to honor the magical part of it, because there's a part of it where it's really, really beyond us, and the story takes on a life of its own, and it's yours. Once it's out in the world, it's yours as much as it's mine.
Right. So when you have that ability to just let the story flow, because some people like to really contain it and got to be in control of things, but you just let it flow out of you. When you've got five issues to wrap this all up, and is that something that was dictated ahead of time, or is that where you saw the story was going?
We usually with a mini series, what I've seen in recent years is people like the six-issue miniseries, often by the sixth issue, no matter what the series is, the sales have taken a dive. It's just the way it seems to go with the market. Okay. So five seems to be a good number. And I know when I do stuff for IDW, five is always their number. So that's dictated at the outset. And so we're going to ask in terms of how do you structure that story out when you're letting it kind of just gush from the unconscious?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's because, you know, after you do this for a while, you're operating on two levels. There's the unconscious, mm-hmm. which you're surrendering to and opening that door. But your conscious mind is the editor on all this. You know, your conscious mind is watching, and your conscious mind knows, okay, this has to wrap up soon. And the truth is, the unconscious knows as well, and things just tend to come together.
Right.
And I guess you can tell when you read a story and all of a sudden everything feels very, 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 very rushed at the end. But for the most part, I find that these things kind of naturally space themselves out. And I can also then look at it and go, okay, we're like halfway through issue four here, and I know I have to get to a certain point by the end. Mm-hmm. I always have an end point, even if by the time I've finished writing, I'm not there. I'm someplace else entirely. It's always good to have an end point in mind, you know? So you play with that. But in the end, it's all about trust. You trust it. You know, with The Girl in the Bay, we only had four issues. We got right. some extra pages in each issue. I would have loved five or six issues for that. So it was a challenge there to kind of balance that unconscious gushing with the knowledge that we have to wrap this up in four issues, which four issues is a pretty tight story.
Yes.
For a story as big as The Girl in the Bay is. And how is that for a transition to talk about the other one?
No, absolutely. That's what I was going to ask next, because this one was a five issue. And then I was surprised that Girl in the Bay was going to be a four. I'm like, wow, this seems like it could be six to eight, because there's a lot. It seems like there's a lot you can unpack here.
There is so much. It could have been, yeah, you know, I could have done a 12 issue series with this one.
Yeah.
And the hope is that if this one does well enough, the story will continue. Okay. And maybe just for those that are listening that don't know the premise, so that I can urge you to run out and buy it. The story starts in the late 60s, 18-year-old girl, Kathy Sartori, who is a kind of a classic hippie of the day, grows up in Brooklyn and basically in the neighborhood that I grew up in, really in the apartment building that I grew up in. And long story short, she's out with her friends one night. She's dropped some acid. She's in an altered state of consciousness. She's at this bar. It's way too crowded for her. She steps outside and meets this guy. And they go out, and they're in Sheepshead Bay, which is an area in Brooklyn which is right on the water. And they go out to the docks. And for what she thinks is a romantic interlude, and the guy takes out a knife. He stabs her, throws her into the bay. She's bleeding out in the water, somehow manages to make her way back to the surface, staggers back across the street into the bar, and discovers that 50 years have passed in the amount of time that she's been underwater. It's now not 1969, it's 2019. And she later discovers not only have 50 years passed, but in those 50 years, someone else has lived out her life. There is a 68-year-old version of herself out there who has been through all of life's ups and downs in marriage and children and career and all these things. And so that's the mystery that we begin with in the first issue. And we actually do get an answer in the final issue as well.
I'm looking forward to it because as I was reading it, and it shocked me too because I knew it was a mature reading audience, but the advisory when you buy it digitally is that it had I forgot the term it used, but like extreme violence in it. And I'm like, wow, this is very different because you just had done The Impossible Inc., which has absolutely no violence in it. And this one, right. It said sadistic violence. And I'm like, sadistic violence? I didn't think it was actually that sadistic.
Yeah, I don't think it was. I mean, there's a murder scene, basically. And that may be the only violence in the whole four issues, you know?
Yeah, but it wasn't sadistic as some other comic books are. No,
it wasn't glorying in it or anything.
No.
It's just, you witness her murder and the brutality of it, and it's not really done in a rubbing your face in it kind of way either.
Not at all.
So I would think calling it sadistic violence is a gross overstatement.
Yeah, I think
and
so too.
I protest.
Yeah, no, for those who are listening and maybe taken aback by it, it isn't sadistic the way it's advised it is. But Catherine, the character, she seems very real. That it almost like it was somebody that you encountered in your life, or there was some sort of personal effect that this person had on you. I know maybe it isn't, but it's like you said, it's taking place so close to home for you. So where did this idea come from?
Well, you know, for me, Kathy was a way to return to my own teenage years. The character is a few years older than I am, but it's the same general feeling of being a teenager, of searching for truth and meaning. I grew up in an era where, you know, drugs were very commonplace. I'm not recommending it to anybody. I'm just saying that's what was going on back then. And in fact, in her case, it leads her down a very bad path, as we see. It was just a way to – there's something about that era that still draws me. I talk about the 60s, say, versus now. In the 60s, when I was growing up, you know, the world was a very, 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 very threatening place. I remember being in the – I guess it was the fourth grade during the infamous Cuban Missile Crisis, when we literally thought – that the world was going to, the entire planet was going to go up in a nuclear fireball in a matter of days, you know? And then the next year, the Kennedy assassination. And then with another year or two, you know, riots in the streets and more assassinations. It was a crazy time. And what fascinates me looking back is that in that crazy time, the response of young people wasn't to freak out and go negative about how screwed up the world was. The response was, you know, rock and roll and peace and love and incredible idealism and the belief that the world could be transformed in the most positive ways. It's pretty extraordinary. You know, now we're in another time where if I was, you know, 17 or 18 years old growing up now, the world is a very, very scary place for a whole different set of reasons.
Right.
And yet the response doesn't necessarily feel to me to be that same response of idealism and hope. So it's an interesting contrast in the times. But I'm very drawn to that time. So Kathy becomes for me a representative of myself in that time, a representative of other people that I knew in that time, and just kind of the flavor of the whole era. But, you know, along with being that, she's just a real three-dimensional person. I really, really think that she comes across on the page, you know, not as a stock character, not as a representative of a certain generation, but as a human being.
Yes.
With all the flaws that go with that. And really, you know, that's the other big leap. One of the other big themes that I'm obsessed with is the swift passage of time. And the longer we live, the more evident that becomes that it's like 1 minute you're 18, the next minute you're 28, the next minute you're 40, the next minute you're 50. You know, years go by in the wink of an eye. They really, really do. Yeah. It seems in the moment like, oh, it's just time is going at this normal flow. And then suddenly, wait, how did that happen? That was 10 years ago.
Right.
And, you know, and it sort of underscores, which is another thing that really we play with in this story, the illusory nature, not just of time, but of existence itself. And you know, you could be laying in bed on any given day, and sometimes I play this little game where it's like, okay, my eyes are closed. How do I feel inside myself? What year is this? How old am I? I feel the same as I did when I, essentially my core self is when I was 17. And yet you open your eyes and you realize you're living in a different time period. The whole time thing has always fascinated me. It's sort of delightful and full of wonder and simultaneously terrifying with the speed with which it passes. And then you take that next step to the illusory nature of life itself, of quote reality itself. And I always put reality in quotes because I don't believe there really is a reality as people accept it. I think it's really an illusion that we're all playing with here.
Explain that. Explain that to me, because it's in both of these books right now, where Goliath Horowitz, which is Number's dad, says, you know, nothing is really real. It's just a construct to, you know, keep things in control. So can you explain that to me, how you see it?
Well, you know, it kind of goes to the core of many, many spiritual and religious paths, and even when you get into sort of quantum physics, the idea that the universe that we take to be solid and real is really just a projection of consciousness. And, you know, you can look at it scientifically and just say that it's really all energy, and we're projecting form onto it, and separation, this idea that there's separation. You know, a Number in Impossible Incorporated, they're driving in the non-local express, comes from the idea that the universe itself is non-local, that there truly is no here or there or distance. It's all one. Mm. You know, the spiritual master Meher Baba had this line, and I'm probably going to mangle it, so I'll paraphrase it. And the idea is, when we say the phrase, say, we are one, even the collective term we is wrong. There is no we. There's just one. And that all this stuff that we take to be reality is not what we see at all, that we are all something far different. We are literally that energy beneath the reality. And then our individual consciousness, it's like projectors, you know? We're all kind of running movies, and really we're all running our own realities and projecting them out there, and all these different projectors are intersecting, and you can kind of take that to infinity, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and I've just kind of like, you know, encapsulated something that's really, it's like I just described the tip of a mountain.
Yeah, no, I get you. But I like hearing it be explained in the simplest way that you can, because it is a big part of the things that you're writing. In both of these stories, you're taking these young women, both 17 years old. Am I correct? Number is 17?
Number 17, Kathy's 18. Kathy has just turned 18. You know, and I didn't realize that until I was in the middle of working on both these books, which started at different times, you know. And I went, oh, wow, I have two teenage female protagonists that are just about the same age. And it wasn't intentional, you know. And then I realized I have the same – there's a little motif in both. At one point in each book, the character repeats the phrase like, my name is Number Horowitz, or my name is Kathy Sartori, and – yeah. You know, and that's kind of where, you know, once I caught on to that, I kind of liked it. Like I was working in two parallel universes that in a strange way were telling similar stories, yet they're totally different. Yeah. And that was kind of the fun of it.
Yeah, that's what I noticed too. This is a time travel, but also a space-time convergence, or you know, things are going wonky in both of these people's lives very differently, but also looking for the same thing, looking for that same meaning and identity.
Right, which is what we're all looking for, right? Yeah. Ultimately, we're all looking, whether it's a sense of personal identity or cosmic identity.
Right.
We're, you know, that's what we're looking for.
So if then that sort of thing in regards to reality and how we've kind of made that be our way to understand things, what in the end would you say are the things that really matter if everything is sort of not the way we imagine it to be? It's just our imagination. What in the end is the crux of it?
The crux of it. Two things to me. One is my experience, you know, everybody's mileage varies. Everybody's experience is different. I'm not putting forth something and saying this is the way it is. This is just the way it has been for me.
Right.
When I have seen those veils pulled back, what I have discovered beneath that is that what the universe is composed of is an energy that we would identify as love. Hmm. A bigger more towering love than anything we could possibly imagine. So that's it in the big cosmic sense. And then you bring that down to the interpersonal sense. And what I want to stress with The Girl in the Bay also is that it's very much a story of character and the relationship between Kathy and the older version of herself and the people that she meets through her. And another really interesting character who pops up, who I don't even want to talk about, but it's, I want to leave that other character out. I don't want to spoil the surprise for people when she encounters this guy. But, you know, then it becomes about how do you express that towering cosmic love in an interpersonal reaction. And that's where the older I get, what I see more and more, that the single most important thing in our lives is compassion. Is to truly, and it's not easy. I don't pretend that it's easy all the time to live a compassionate life. Sometimes it's the hardest thing in the world and I fail miserably, you know, but really
that's part of the learning though. Is to fail miserably is part of that learning, right? Yeah. To learn to be compassionate
absolutely.
Next time. Yeah.
And to forgive yourself when you do. Right. It's as much in the trying as it is in the succeeding. But to really, I think that's what we all really crave at our core. We want to be treated compassionately and kindly, with some respect, with some love, you know? And that one-on-one human interaction of that compassion to me is what ends up being the doorway to that larger, more cosmic love and compassion.
Yeah, I've been saying in conversations with people as I get older, because so you grew up in a world where, depending on where you come from and your culture, of course, there's people who look at everything relatively, and then you've got the people who really love the absolute aspect of things, you know, this is the way it is, and this is truth or this is fact, and you don't have to think more than that, thankfully. You know, that's kind of the approach people take. But I've noticed is that instead of having people agree all the time, in line with what you're saying, being able to understand, we can disagree, yes, but we understand each other, which where the compassion comes in.
But exactly, compassion is definitely a doorway to understanding, being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes.
Right.
And it can be very hard in a polarized time like this, you know? But what I find is, for me, what I found in life is it's really, really easy to have those massive negative feelings when the other is in a group.
Mm.
But when you meet people one-on-one,
right,
people are people. And hearts are hearts.
It changes,
you know,
yeah.
And that's why I've always I've never really particularly, you know, even if in terms of following my own spiritual path, I'm not fond of groups. I'm not fond of crowds, really, in general.
Yeah,
I like one-on-one connection with people more
myself
than anything.
Too. Myself,
you know,
too.
The smaller the group, the better, and one-on-one even better. You know, I really like that because that's the way to sort of pull away the veils, cut away the bullshit, and get down to the heart-to-heart business of being human. And like I said, that becomes the doorway to that larger truth or that larger energy, whatever you want to call it.
Right, yeah.
And even if you don't believe in that other aspect of things.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt to do it. It doesn't hurt to be compassionate or loving.
Right. You don't have to believe in anything to be compassionate. In fact, you know, there are a lot of people that specifically say, look, I don't believe in God or any higher power. I just believe in the ethics of living a decent life, you know, and that's just as viable and just as valuable.
Right.
It's the decency and the compassion that matters.
Right. Yeah, that's great. It's a good point. So a little more on Girl in the Bay. Winston Burton.
Yeah, okay, that was the character that I wasn't going to mention before.
I'm
but okay,
sorry.
We can talk about that.
I'm
fine.
Sorry. I didn't know if that
okay.
was somebody
okay.
coming up in another issue. But
right. I guess if someone starts, he doesn't show up until the second issue, so we kind of set him up in the first issue. But
yeah.
We can talk about it. It's okay.
I looked him up because I thought that was – I could be wrong. I thought that was somebody that – this is a rock star that I don't know. I should look up who this
funny.
Is.
Oh, that's great. That's great that you
so
did that.
So I actually looked it up, and I'm like, who's Winston Burton? And all these other people were coming up on Facebook, and I'm like, no, that can't – that's not a rock star. So then I kind of figured out I think this is supposed to be one of JM's favorite people. I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, there's certainly not so much the character himself. Well, we know we're talking about John Lennon, right?
Yeah.
the character isn't, you know, isn't just John Lennon with another name, but it is sort of a representation. And we all, you know, especially if you're into music or if you're into writing, there's always that one, or any kind of art, there's always that one figure that has, that kind of towers over the rest for you. Absolutely. You know, I have it with music, you know, with the Beatles and with Lennon. I have it with certain writers. It could be a painter, it could be a poet, it could be anything. Some people, it's a political figure. Mm-hmm. But that person that whose life and work connects with you on such a deep level that they become so important in your life, and even though you don't know them, through their art and through their life, you have a very intimate relationship with them.
100%, yeah.
And that's what Winston Burton is to Kathy. He was her rock and roll hero growing up. And yeah, you know, I threw in sort of a mixture of things there, you know.
It seems like an amalgamation of different people.
Yeah. You know, I guess I wanted the spirit of Lennon in a way. If, you know, probably if I thought it would have been legally okay, I would have used John Lennon as the figure that appears in the story. But, you know, it's better that it's not, because then everyone can bring their figure like that to the page and project that onto Winston Burton. But, you know, John Lennon's middle name was Winston, so that's where the Winston came from. And I don't know where I got Burton from. I just pulled it out of the air.
Okay, because I was even looking up, like, what were John Lennon's, like, pseudonyms, if he had them. Because I know a lot of even comic book writers or artists go by other names at times when, they don't want to be associated or wanted to do a side project that wouldn't be affected by publishing or whatever the case may be. So I'm like, is this John Lennon's other name that I just learned? But, okay. I'm glad I got that cleared up. Sorry if I spoiled it. I do apologize. No, I can edit it out.
You know, here's the other thing that I realized, and someone pointed out to me a while ago. It, frankly, you know, we used to be very slow. Let's not give away the details of this and details of that. It's such a fierce market out there that on one level, the more we let people know it's in the story, the more they may be eager to go and pick it up and check it out. True. So it's okay. So we should say that, you know, she's stepped 50 years into her future. And she's, you know, and she's realizing that she's sort of, something weird is going around also with her perception. And she's walking through the West Village, and she comes basically across the spirit of this rock star that she's idolized all her life, who, it turns out, this is the place where he lived when he died, and his spirit has more or less been trapped there by his fans, you know. Mm-hmm. And the idea of that came to me because of remembering when John Lennon was killed and those hundreds, if not thousands, of people that gathered outside the Dakota in the days after he died, and that still go to the Dakota to sort of pay their respects, and the idea that all these people, you know, all have that same intimate relationship in their heads, at least, that we all do with these figures in our lives, and all sort of project a certain version of that person. Mm. And so what we see that Winston Burton is not necessarily the literal ghost of that character, but the projected image of that person,
right?
That's been sort of created by the people that that are fans of his.
Yeah, the memory of his.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, just the memory that people have all amalgamated of this person and everything that he embodied to the population is what is what he you know appears as to Catherine in the story.
And then it come play, you know, this whole story plays with identity. You know, who is Kathy if this other version of Kathy exists? Which, who's real, who's not real? Are we both real or neither real? And the same thing with Burton. Who's the real Winston Burton? Is he the projection of what his fans believe he is, or is he something else? You know, so that whole thing of identity really weaves through the story. And he's very important, as you'll see in the finale, on a lot of different levels. The character is very important.
Yeah, I was thinking for a second when I was reading issue 2 when Catherine encounters her older self, and you know there's the question of who's the real one. I'm like, he's not going down the clone saga thing again. But then I saw it's only 4 issues, so we're good.
I will tell you now, there is not a single clone to be found in this story.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
it's okay. We've been talking for about 40 minutes just about the things you're working on now, which makes me so happy that you've got 2 new books coming on the shelf, and they're independent books, having been, you know, known mainly for your big 2 work in a lot of ways. How does it feel in regards to the difference between working independent and working for Marvel or DC? What do you prefer?
Well, you know, first of all, that's been a part of my career going back to the 80s, you know, when I did Moonshadow at Epic Comics, working on creator-owned stuff has always been really important to me. I was there for the launch of Epic with Moonshadow, which I also have to plug, coming out in June from Dark Horse.
Absolutely.
A beautiful hardcover Ultimate Moonshadow with all 12 issues, the sequel, lots of extras. We dug up some amazing stuff to include in the extra section. But, you know, whether it was Moonshadow and Blood at Epic, I was, you know, involved with Vertigo right from the very, very beginning, and Paradox Press. And so I've always done this kind of stuff. And it's always been really, really important to me to be able to step out of those universes and work on things that are more personal. And it's one of the things that's allowed me to continue to do this for so many years and stay sane. I mean, I love the Marvel and DC characters. And every time I get to play with them, and, you know, in recent years, I've done a lot of animation. So worked with these characters, not just in comics, but in animation. In fact, the past year, I've done a ton of new things, most of which I can't talk about because they won't be out for another year or so. So I continue to play with those characters, and I love them, and I respect them, and it's really fun. But it's really important to step away from that as well and just create something from your heart, from the ground up. You know, just this is it. This is from the depths of my imagination. This is from the deeps of my heart. And here it is. And there's something so liberating about that and so joyful about that. So I always like to balance those things and have a little bit of both.
That's awesome. I'm looking forward to the Moonshadow because I've never actually gotten a chance to read it. I've heard wonderful things about it.
Oh,
so
great.
to have it being able to read it for the first time, it'll be exciting, and I'll email you to give you my reaction to it, because a lot of people always say, "Oh, I wish I could go back and, you know, watch that from your perspective or read it for the first time." So I'm excited to get this put it on my shelf, physical copy of it.
And our editor at Dark Horse, who's putting this together, Philip Simon, we met years ago, and he's a huge Moonshadow fan. I think he wrote like a thesis in college about Moonshadow. You know, He's like, happy to be working on this project, and he is pouring all the love and attention that he's got onto this project and making sure that it's really, really going to be a beautiful book. And, you know, it's been out of print for a couple of years, and Philip was like the perfect guy to do it, and Dark Horse is doing a great job with it, and I'm really, really excited about it, and I really can't wait for that book to be back out into the world.
That's awesome. Can we switch gears just a little and talk a little about Marvel DC?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm sure you hear or have people ask you questions about it all the time. You're at cons with Mike Zeck talking about Kraven's Last Hunt, but Nick Spencer has been doing a lot with the character with this new storyline he's got going on. I'm not sure if you've been paying attention to it, but how do you feel that people still revere this story to the point that he might not be rehashing the story, but it's definitely playing on the story that you told in some capacity?
So that's really two questions, right? Yes. So how do I feel about the fact that people still love this story and that something new is being done with it, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Okay, I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah.
you know, how do I feel about the first part, that people still love it? I feel profoundly grateful. You know, I go to conventions and I say to this day, a third of what I'm signing in some way, shape, or form is Kraven's Last Hunt. It just is. For whatever reason, that story clicked, it connected, and over the years, it's grown, you know? It's grown in stature. And, you know, if you have one book like that, let alone a few out there that do that, that's a great thing. So, you know, sometimes, and I am in no way, shape, or form comparing myself with Orson Welles, so bear with me on this. But you used to hear the stories of Orson Welles going, "Oh my God, all they want to do is talk about Citizen Kane, you know? And I've done all this other work. What about Chimes at Midnight? What about this? What about that?" And, you know, sometimes you feel like, "Oh my God, Kraven's Last Hunt again?" And then I take a half step back and I go, "That's phenomenal. It's 31 years later. People are still reading it for the first time. The people that read it 30 years ago, people come and say, oh, I like to read it every year. I like to go back to it." And that, you know, you can't ask for anything more than to have a story like that live on. So really, I'm incredibly grateful. And I think I was just at a convention recently, you know, with Zeck and McLeod, and we did a panel, and you know, you get asked a lot of the same questions about it. But even to this day, sometimes someone will ask a question, and I'll go, you know, I never thought about that. Let me take it. And I find some new insight into my own work that I never knew was there 30 years later because someone asked an interesting question. So the answer to that part is basically I am profoundly grateful that this story has lived on. And in terms of the other part, I have read about this new story. I have not read the story, so I can't comment on the story itself, and I probably wouldn't even if I had read it because it's not my job to critique somebody else's writing. And I know Nick Spencer is an excellent writer. So same thing. Let those story elements live on. Let people play with them. That's the nature of comics, you know. You know, they brought Kraven back to life. What was it, about 5 or 6 years ago? And they did it with what was it called, Grim Hunt, which I thought was an excellent story, and they did it in a really nice way. You know, that the character stayed dead for whatever it was, 20 years or 25 mm-hmm. years, was really, for comics, that's pretty remarkable. You know, considering Aunt May stayed dead about 15 minutes before they brought her back.
I always complain about that, but yeah.
They could have let her be dead a little bit longer.
Just a little bit, yeah. I don't. It would have been okay.
So yeah, you know, you're part of a cooperative universe, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not, you know, once that story is in print, that's part of the Marvel Universe, and dozens, if not hundreds, more people are going to come along and play with that universe and play with those elements just the same way that I did when I came along and said, ooh, remember that old story that I liked so much? What if we spin this way? And I loved that old character, and there was that element in there that I thought was so fascinating. I can build a whole story. You know, that's the nature of a shared universe.
Right.
So I'm grateful that I made a contribution that people still want to return to.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I just was talking with Mike Zeck and John Beattie, who were visiting Toronto for the Toronto Comic Con. And, you know, we were talking a little bit about Secret Wars. And they said for the first couple of years when it was, you know, being celebrated, it was not their favorite thing that they had worked on. It was a job that they were given to do. But
right.
They've gotten over the fact that, you know, people love it, and it's better that there's something that people appreciate, even though they didn't necessarily like it. But in this case, this is something that you were proud of to work on, the collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So you can look at it with that sense of like, well, I didn't want to do this, but I had to. It's nice that you like it. At least, you know, that fulfillment is completely there.
Yeah, as we've probably talked about the last time, you know, the Kraven story came out of a very specific era in my life when I was really wrestling with a lot of personal issues, and a lot of that just kind of flooded into that story. So that story, for good or for ill, came from the depths of my soul. You know, it was not like just another job. You know, and the truth is, you know, once you sit down to write, even if going into it, it feels like just another job, it can't be that when you're sitting there writing the story. It can't. The minute you sit down to write, once you've accepted that assignment, you can't go, oh, it's just another job, I just have to go. No, you have to pour your heart and soul into it anyway. But to go to basically kind of what Mike and John were saying, you know, there one of the reasons why I've learned over the years never to knock any of my own work in public, I may slip up occasionally, you know, is because I know just because I'm not happy with a given story doesn't mean there's not someone else out there that loves that story. And I've seen it over and over again over the years. So I may, you know, look back at some story and just see the flaws in it, and someone else picks that story up and it resonates with them in some way, some very, very deep way, and I have to respect that. And along with respecting that, what I've had to learn to respect is my younger self, my right. younger writer's self, because like it's very easy to look at, say, my early work and go, oh, I don't like the construction of that sentence, or ooh, that dialogue there, what was I thinking,
right.
you know? But, you know, I see other people, they don't see that. They see the whole of the story.
100%.
And it means something to them. And so I see things from early in my career that over the years I see that people have really, really have tremendous respect for, that for years I walked around going, oh, my God, I really screwed that up, or oh, I'm embarrassed by that story. And I've learned to let a lot of that go and have some more respect for what I was able to achieve at a point when I thought I didn't even have the skill to achieve it, you know? There are a couple of writers, Brian Keene and oh my God, I'm blanking. That's a terrible thing. Christopher Golden, that's it. They do this Defenders Dialogue podcast, and they spent, I don't know how many months going over my issues with Defenders, which was something that I did very early at Marvel. You know, so I look back at Defenders and I go, same thing. Oh, that caption. Oh, that dialogue there. But listening to these two respected adult successful writers talking about these stories and what it meant to them when they read them and how much respect for them they have now made me look at it very, very differently. And I, like I said, I've seen that with a number of things over the years where I may have one opinion of it. And then you go out into the world and you see all the people that took those stories into their hearts. And, you know, who am I to get up and go, no, that story was really terrible. You know, no, it's not. It's not the way it works. So, I keep going back to the word gratitude, but it's true. I'm just incredibly grateful when I see that happening. And again, it makes me view my young writer self with more kindness and with more respect.
Yeah. I think, too, like, I could be wrong because other writers might approach it this way as well. But in your case, from the little that I do know about you, is that you're also a musician. So the way that mm-hmm. you write, I feel it's almost the way a musician makes music. You do it very much in the place where you currently are to draw that inspiration, whether you're going through pain, whether you're elated, in love, whatever the case may be. So for you to say that Craven's Last Hunt was written at a specific time in your life, it's I appreciate it because as someone goes back to read these things, you're learning about the writer as well as they're just telling an imaginary story. But there's something to be said about that writer as well, which is kind of like albums. You know, you
right? Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And you know, I talk in my writing workshops, and I will plug one of those in a minute too, about the link between music and writing. And for me, because I was and am a musician, I approach writing in a musical way. There's something fundamental once you've been a musician. It's almost like, and I've said this and I feel and I know that it's true and yet I can't explain it, but that creatively you tend to approach everything musically. And you know, I could sit down and dissect a comic book page and look at it musically. Look at here, okay, here's the beat, here's the melody, you know, here's the guitar solo, you know.
There's time that you got to make most of, right? Just like the same way you do in like 16 bars of music, you got the same thing on a page. You transfer time.
Right. Each page is almost like it could be an entire song. It could be a verse of the song. It's interesting. You know, even I've talked about even the way the rhythm of each individual captions, because you know, it's comics are interesting because they're prose, but they're also poetry. They're also song lyrics because you're not writing to the page in a way when you're crafting the prose. You're plotting maybe to the page, but you're writing to the caption. And there's a rhythm and a flow from caption to caption, and caption, dialogue, sound effect, caption. It's musical and it flows, and you have to choose it in a really specific way. And each thing takes on a different part of the song, if you will. The caption is one aspect of the song. The dialogue is another. The sound effects are another aspect of the song. I know a lot of people don't realize. I get people saying, so I guess the letterer makes up all the sound effects. No, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
The writer writes those sound effects and places them in the story, and the letterer does a beautiful job of illustrating those sound effects. But that's part of the artistic choice. What sound effects do you choose? How do you use them? How do you repeat them? You know, what's the rhythm of that? So it is. It's a very musical process.
Yeah, and those nuances make or break it. Those little things that we kind of take for granted because we just go right through it, they do make a huge difference.
Right. And, you know, the reader should take it for granted. The reader should just take it in as a whole.
Right.
You know? But it's and again, I sometimes it's conscious, and a lot of times, you know, after all these years, it's just intuitive. But it's very rhythmic, it's very musical. A great thing about comics, you know, it's visual. There's a place where it's like prose. There's a place where it's like poetry. There's a place where it's like music. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this incredible hybrid of different elements that then can be used in 1,000 different ways.
Right.
You know, a comic book isn't one thing or another. There is no one way or right way to do a comic book. I remember talking about Moonshadow. When Moonshadow came out, someone, an artist that I liked and respect, read and said, yeah, but it's not a comic book. And so the answer is, well, what's a comic book? It's any combination of words and pictures that we choose to put together in any way that we choose to put it together. And if I want three pages in a row where there's a lot of prose with one illustration, and then three pages in a row where it's all panels and art and not a word on it, and any combination thereof, that's the comic book.
Right.
Because I say so, or whoever's creating the comic book says so. So I will mention before I forget, before we run out of time, that it's been quite a while since I've done one of my writing workshops, and I have one scheduled for November. I know it sounds early, but people are registering already. It's in Kingston, New York, which is a couple hours north of New York City, an hour south of Albany. And I've had people come from all over the country and from other countries. So if it sounds far away, think twice. It's a 3-day workshop. We go from Friday to Sunday. We talk about all the practicalities of writing for comics and animation, how all the pieces are put together and fit together. And we also talk about the things that you and I have been talking about, the metaphysics of writing. It's a really, really wonderful, intimate. I like to keep the class small.
Yeah.
It's a great weekend. So if you go to my website, which is jmdmateus.com, there's a section on workshops. You check the information is there. Or you could email me at imaginationworkshops@gmail.com. But I haven't done one of these in probably a couple of years, so I'm really excited that I'm going to get to do one again.
I wish I lived a little bit closer. I just love to be a fly on the wall in that room. That'd be awesome. Before we go, can I get you some rapid-fire questions?
Okay, let's see if I can spit out some answers without making an ass of myself.
No. They might not be rapid answers. You can answer however you like. I just wanted to make sure I asked you some of these before we go. So, you worked on both the Marvel and DC. I would think kind of equivalents of each other. Doctor Fate, Doctor Strange. Which one do you have a leaning for?
Wow. See, I'm already stumped.
That's okay.
As a character, I love Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange has always been one of my favorite characters. So on that level, I would choose Doctor Strange. But why I love Doctor Fate is that I did a miniseries that Keith Giffen drew, and then I did a 2-year run on Doctor Fate with Sean McManus on the art, and it was we talked about going off and doing the creator-owned personal work and doing the mainstream work. Well, Doctor Fate was basically a creator-owned series disguised as a mainstream DC book. It was so intensely personal. I got to write about everything I could ever want to write about in exactly the way I wanted to write about it, which is one of the reasons why I think at the time when the book was coming out, people had a hard time because, well, is it a superhero book? Well, kind of. Well, it's sort of a supernatural book, yeah, but it's also kind of funny, but it's also philosophical and spiritual. And what is this book? Well, the book, what it was everything I was thinking and feeling at the time that I was writing it. Right. So although as a character, I probably would say, yes, Doctor Strange, that's the character that I love. But boy, those years writing Doctor Fate were heaven for me because it was just such a great series to work on. And I had such freedom to create those stories exactly the way I wanted to. And really, essentially, I created my own Dr. Fate, with the help of obviously with Keith, who worked on the miniseries, and then with Sean as the artist on the ongoing. But it was a Dr. Fate that existed for as long as we did those books. And then we left and that Dr. Fate was no more. So it really was a very, very personal book. So I'll 6 of 1, half a dozen of the, like I said, Dr. Strange, great character. I love the character regardless of my own, whatever work I've done on the character, but Dr. Fate, it's really personal.
Right. It's more of a window into you, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So when you work on characters like that who are, in mystical, supernatural, how much research do you do into those genres, or do you just write whatever you make it up as you go along? Because I know some people really dig deep into, magic and knowing how it works and all of those things. Did you do that with those characters?
Not so much the magic part, but there's a difference between magic and mysticism. I look at mysticism as sort of a more spiritual thing, whereas magic is that sort of more kind of creepy occult thing,
Right, okay.
And when it comes to the mystical side of things, I've been reading that kind of material, since I was a teenager. So that's just sort of in my bones,
Right.
And so the research that I've done for that kind of stuff is 90% of the time just my life, I may come across a book that or something in a book and go, oh, that would be so great to use in a story. But it's really, for the most part, just comes out of the reading that I've done and from the internal experiences that I've had in my life.
Right. Good to know. I'm always interested in how deep people go into those, because for me, like those things in the magic, the occult, the dark arts, it's never been my speed, but
yeah.
Reading, things like that you've had, like Brooklyn Dreams, where they go into those places. If that's the kind of direction you might take with a Dr. Fate, who's, you know, superhero, humorous, and there's all these other philosophical elements, that'd be an amazing read.
Right, right. And as I said, you know, like the sort of occult, that kind of like, quote, magic where people talk about, I can play with that. I mean, I wrote this animated John Constantine a series that came out on DVD in October, and you can watch for free parts of it on CWC. And I can play in that world, and I like horror, and I like dark fantasy, but that's not a realm that I'm playing in my life in any way, shape, or form.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. You can fictionalize it, but you don't want to study the
right. Aspect, right? And even that I look at as a way to externalize the internal journey and the internal battles that we have, you know what I mean? As opposed to, you know, if I'm writing about a battle with a demon, I'm talking ultimately about our own inner demons and how do we deal with them and transcend them, you know?
100%.
Whereas some people, you know, you hear about some people and they're like, they're getting into this stuff and they're like playing with spells and stuff. And so that's not, you know, God bless you. Go have fun. That's not for me.
Yes. And it always worries me when I've read something that, you know, oh, this is a great Justice League run. But then you figure out that, wait a second, where was this guy when he was doing this? So I always wonder about that.
To each his own, right?
To each his own. That's it. Okay. So if Moonshadow had a soundtrack, what would it be?
Moonshadow had a soundtrack. Well, two things come to mind. Because the flute is so central to the story, as you'll see when you read it, there's a flute that is a recurring central symbol and theme of the story. The first thing I hear is sort of ambient/new agey floaty flute music.
Okay.
Okay. And the other thing that comes to mind is the Cat Stevens song Moonshadow. a bunch of Cat Stevens songs on the soundtrack of a Moonshadow movie would be great, because his songs, many of his songs are exactly about the things we've been talking about, and that search for meaning, that search for that unity, for that energy behind the universe. So Cat Stevens songs wouldn't be bad on a soundtrack to a Moonshadow movie.
Yeah, I was thinking that you might say that, but I thought this because of the visuals of it, you definitely want to have something to add to that effect of the reading journey.
Right, and that's where the sort of ambient, floaty, spacey, strange music that sort of opens up another layer of reality comes in.
Right. So speaking of universes, when you've written simultaneously for Marvel and DC, is there a mental space that you are able to channel when you enter Marvel Universe as opposed to DC Universe? Is there a switch that you turn on and off for both?
You know, I don't think in terms of universes. I think in terms of characters.
Okay.
And a character is a character. And you hook into that character. Does it really matter if it's Spider-Man and he's in the Marvel Universe or Batman and he's in the DC Universe? What matters is the character and your connection to that character and what you can bring to that character. What new things can you possibly say about that character? So no, I don't think about that. Like you said, I've done it all simultaneously, worked, you know, Marvel and DC, and then done my creator own stuff and, you know, worked in all these different genres, or then jumped over and worked in film or animation or whatever. It's all about the story and the characters. So, no, I don't have a Marvel mindset or a DC mindset. I really don't. I have a character mindset.
Okay. Awesome. So, speaking of characters, what would be your ideal JLA roster if you could pick them? Because when you wrote the JLA, you couldn't have any of the big three. You were given what you were given. Do you have a roster in your head that you would love to tackle?
You know, it's interesting because I got to write R. Giffen DeMatteis McGuire JLI, you know, which I never really thought of as the Justice League, because it was so different.
Right.
And yet there's a whole generation of people that think of that as their Justice League, you know.
Absolutely.
So that's so interesting. But, you know, I wrote for Justice League Unlimited, so I got to write the classic characters, and that's always fun. So it's sort of like the Doctor Strange, Doctor Fate question. In a way, yeah, I love the classic Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, Green Lantern thing. But I'm so personally connected to our Justice League that those are the people that are my friends. You know what I mean?
Right.
They're the ones that I know intimately and have complete three-dimensional reality to me, and are the ones I would like to hang out with on Saturday night, you know? At the same time, you know, the 10-year-old in me is always going to go Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Flash, Green Lantern, you know? So again, there's the sort of the iconic version where I adore those characters in the classic Justice League, but there's my connection to the JLI, which is really, really personal.
Yeah, for sure. So speaking of Superman, is it as hard to write Superman as everybody says it is? I know you haven't had a long, extensive run to really flesh it out, but with what you have written, is he as difficult to crack?
Yeah, you know, I haven't done, you know, I worked on it, Adventures of Superman, for a period of time. I did a couple of Superman graphic novels, wrote Superman in Justice League Unlimited. The answer is, I think you have to do kind of what I said before, which is what you have to do with any character, which is find something new to explore. At the same time, be true to the essence of who and what that character is. And, you know, I did a story with Liam Sharp, must have been in 2004 or something like that, called a Superman story, graphic novel called Where Is Thy Sting? And I was thinking, no one ever thought about this. I'm thinking, if I was the lone survivor of the planet Krypton, I'm the only one that made it out. Where is survivor's guilt in his psychology, you know? And I said, I don't know if I've ever come across a story where anyone ever dealt with that before. And I use that as the doorway into that particular story. So there's that aspect. So is he difficult? Probably it's difficult because the character's been around for 80 years. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. And yet there's something in the essence of these iconic characters that have been with us for 80 years. And it's the reason why they have been with us for 80 years, because there's something basic and fundamental and true and with Superman infinitely admirable, you know? Superman has gone beyond being a character to being like an aspect of our collective consciousness, you know? You don't have to have ever read a Superman comic to know Superman and to understand what he means to us individually, you know? He's become both a character and, you know, I often think that, you know, in the old days, people created gods based on some fundamental energy in the universe.
Right.
And I think a lot of these iconic characters that are now in the forefront in the form of superheroes, that maybe once upon a time people looked up to a certain god, and now we've created Superman to embody that for us in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe the same energy that embodied that god thousands of years ago is the same energy that has found embodiment through this comic book image, and that there's the image, this is going to get out there again, but
that's
this
okay.
Is kind of stuff we talk about in this class of mine too. There's the image, you know, a couple of kids from Cleveland created Superman, but what did they create? Did they create a vehicle for an energy that's been around for thousands of years that needed to be embodied as this character, you know? And when you get into these fundamental primal characters, even something like Mickey Mouse, that, you know, you don't have to have ever seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon or read a Mickey Mouse comic book. To me, Mickey Mouse symbolizes sort of the unfettered, everything that's symbolized in the best of Disney, which is really, to me, the power of imagination, of our imaginations to concretely manifest things in life, you know? So the energy that we invest in Mickey Mouse now, was that some, you know, god of creativity 5,000 years ago? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea to play with, that these same energies get embodied in different ways, and that they are at once a fictional construct, and on the other hand, there's something else entirely that exists almost independent of the character.
Yeah.
And that went way deeper.
No, than I love it. I love it. When you break it down like that, I'm on the ride, and then I listen to it again. It's great. Okay. So one last question before you go, because it's just last week it was Detective Comics 1000, huge landmark issue for Batman. You've written Batman in you know, comic miniseries, Spider-Man, Batman.
A lot of Batman.
You've written a lot of Batman. You've never had that one, you know, Batman 200 issue run, let's say, but you've written a lot, even in animated features. What is your favorite personal Batman story you've written, and one that you enjoy reading yourself?
Of the Batman stories that I've written, that's easy. I did an arc in Legends of the Dark Knight. I think it was in the mid or late 90s called Going Sane.
Going Sane, yeah.
And that I think is not just my favorite Batman story that I've done, but it's just, if I look at all the mainstream superhero stories that I've done, it may be my absolute favorite. And if it's not, you know, given the day, it's in the top two. You know what I mean? So I'm very, very proud of that
story.
What
would be the other one? That's the question, too.
Yeah, and that depends on the day, too. You know, I know I'm supposed to say Kraven's Last Hunt, and Kraven's probably up there in the top five, but I have other Spider-Man stories that, as stories.
Child Within.
Child Within, a Spectacular Spider-Man 200, with the death of Harry Osborn.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the thing with Kraven was that for whatever reason – Kraven resonated out there in the world in a way that it just took on a life of its own. But I have, like I said, a couple of other Spider-Man stories that I would say, oh, I think that's even a better story than Kraven. But that goes back to what we were saying before. What do I know? You know, if the audience has decided that that's a better story, that's
I think
okay
the presentation of Kraven's Last Hunt too, because it was out of the blue, it went through every book of Spider-Man, so it gave it a certain gravitas as the readers. I guess at that time, I was too young to appreciate it in that terms, but I understand now. It's like, wow, that went in Web, it went in Spectacular, amazing. So you took over the whole Spider-Man office for that time,
right?
So I think that, you know, makes that impact even stronger with people. But go ahead.
And then there's chemistry. You know, there was a chemistry whenever I worked with Zek, and when, you know, Zek worked with McLeod. And I always say, it even comes down to the coloring and the lettering. All these elements come together. And just as there's chemistry between people, there's chemistry between creative people, and then there's chemistry between the story and the audience. So I may have another story over here that you may have never heard of that I think is the best thing I've ever written, but it never had the chance to get out there, or just like when you meet a person at a party, there's that chemical click just isn't there.
Right.
And Kraven had that chemical click. And it was sort of like, you know, love between the audience and the story and between the creators. And it all created this chemistry that made this story that's lived on. Same thing with JLI. You know, why has that lived on for 30 years? I don't know. At the time, it really was just another gig. It was only 10 years later that we all went, well, that was really cool. We should do that again. You know? So I got off the track. So in terms of Batman stories that I've loved, I'll think of two things. When I was a kid, and someone just asked me about this the other day. There was a story called Robin Dies at Dawn. And I must have been, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old when I read it. And the cover, it's a classic cover, which you've probably seen. It's Batman holding Robin's dead body in his arms while the sun is sort of setting. No, obviously Robin Dies at Dawn. It's rising, blood red behind him, you know. One of the greatest covers. And it completely freaked me out and impacted me as a kid because he'd never seen anything like that. Robin's dead. And the story ended up being a cheat. You know, it ended up being, you know, Robin wasn't dead. And it was this whole kind of goofy story as those stories in that era were. But while I was reading it as a kid, that story meant the world to me. And even with the end, it left an impact that I've never forgotten. Was it a great story? I don't know. But it's a story that stayed with me since I'm 8 or 9 years old. So there's that. And then if I was going to, God, pick my favorite Batman run, if I was forced to, I'd say the Steve Englehart, Marshall Rogers run, which is just as perfect a bunch of Batman stories as you're ever going to find. Wonderful stories, wonderful characters. You know, Batman is, quote, the Dark Knight, but he's not just this grim, dark thing. He's really three-dimensional and human. You feel both Batman and the Bruce Wayne underneath the mask. The villains are just written to perfection. There's wonderful supporting characters. Anyone out there that's never read that Steve Englehart run, you have to get your hands on it. Read it. They're just perfect Batman stories.
Yeah, you know, you're right, because I've always heard that about that run that he did with Marshall Rogers, but they don't have it in print in a accessible way. I mean, you could get it digitally, but it's a shame. There's a lot of good stuff that he's done that even yourself, there's a lot of collections that they need to release that you've worked on.
Going Sane is out of print. They put it out a few years ago and in a collected edition, and you can't get it now.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I found it. Thankfully, I found a copy of it, but, you know, The Child Within should be in one of those epic collections. Your Spectacular one should be collected.
Child Within, it's like, they printed it in Italy recently. They did it in South America, you know? And it's like, wait a minute. So they're doing it in Italy and South America, all over the world. They're not doing it here. There's certain ones where I don't understand. Certain ones I understand why they haven't gotten around to collect them. Other ones, you know, when it's Spider-Man and it's a well-respected story and they're printing it all over the world. I saw Zach was tweeting recently about the fact that our Captain America run, they put out in a big omnibus of our stuff in Italy. You know, it's been collected in other places in the world, and it's only come out a story here, a story there in the United States. But, you know, as the creators, we have no control over that.
Yeah.
When I read the coming comics, when they announce what's coming out in a given month, and I see, oh, look, there's some collection of mine coming out, I'm finding out the same time that everyone else is.
Yeah.
I don't get any advance warning 90% of the time.
Well, with these epic collections that they're doing now, a lot of your things are going to be getting collected in due time. I'm sure of it.
And yeah, I just saw that my Daredevil run is coming out in a Daredevil collection, I think, in the next couple of months. My Silver Surfer run is coming out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they do eventually get around to it. But I would love to see the Spider-Man stuff really, you know, collected, especially that Spectacular Spider-Man run with Sal Buscema in a really big, fat, nice omnibus edition.
Well, it's a nice set of story. Like, it's an arc, right? It's a great place to start and end. So it's a perfect thing to have an omnibus. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate your.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I really, because we always get into some really interesting spaces. So
yeah, no, I love really it. Well, when I get the Moonshadow, maybe I'll reach out to you again, and we can have a discussion about that collection and some other things you've done. I want to ask about Speeding Bullets, because that's a favorite story of mine, but maybe next time.
We'll save that for next time, yeah. That'd be great. That'd be great. Okay.
Thank you so much. You have a great night. So there you have it, everybody. Another edition with the one and only J.M. DeMatteis. It's always a pleasure talking to him, because I love where he takes us as far as the storytelling aspect is concerned, and also with just life lessons that you get from his life experience and what he adds to the stories that we're reading. So if you want to leave us a review on iTunes, that would be great, very helpful. It always helps to get the show out there to more people. As well, you can follow us on Facebook, you can follow us on Instagram, email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. And also, don't forget to check out a couple of my other favorite podcasts. If you enjoy comic book interviews like this one, you can listen to The Comic Shenanigans. You can also listen to Fastball Special from my good buddy, Martin Slam Duncan. And if you want to get your hands on some of the books that we were talking about today with J.M. DeMatteis, hit up Cyber City Comics, Steeles and Carpenter Road, close to Steeles and Bathurst if you live in the GTA, Greater Toronto Area. And if not, hit up website, Digital Comics, find a local comic shop near you. But if you are in the GTA, head over to Cyber City Comics, tell them Eric from the Cave of Solitude sent you, and you're looking for books from J.M. DeMatteis. You will not be disappointed. There's a ton of things on the shelves that he's written in the last 30 years that are, you know, hallmark comic book stories, as we've discussed here today. You will surely enjoy them, and they'll be a great addition to your book collection, regardless of them being comic books or just prose novels. This has been Eric Anthony. Thank you again for listening, and we will be back soon with more comic book goodness.